A62. Number 18A.
So we come to the fourth synonymous term, the fourth period in the illustration of Samuel. What did you feel was here the main problem or the main idea that they wanted to bring out? Yes? The establishment of true government. Yeah. In which way would you feel that the illustration brings that out? Just outwardly? Yes?
Well, the fact that Saul was always turning backward and not following principles.
Yes?
Then David kept right on the line, following and finding his true manhood and womanhood.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
Which enabled him to then demonstrate.
Yes?
And work according to the divine gospels and not the mortal gospels.
Yes?
Or to get that more established.
How was that establishment of true government symbolized in just two, three words in the story?
One of the ways, I think, where the Ziklag was burned, because he had not yet identified it spiritually as a system.
Uh-huh. Yes. Well, it's going into a small details, yes. But what happened in that period, yes, Ruth?
Well, it was the uniting of Judah and Israel, the two factions.
Yes, they were united.
Established one government.
Yes. Was that not in the tone of life? What happened in a few words? You see, the epitome was so nice. It was the establishment of true government. Why had a true government be established? Because there were two governments, huh? There. The story is that you had the government of Saul and the government of David, but only outwardly the government of Saul was established outwardly. Therefore, in order to establish really true government, Saul was killed and his kingdom lost, and David was made king of Judah. Hmm? Just as a point to remember what happened here. It was actually now the the proving of what true government is, that therefore Saul's government could not go on side by side with David's government, and somehow there must have come a period where it was proved what true government is, and you can only prove what true government is in the way that wrong government is being destroyed. So in that period we have the destruction of Saul's government by Saul killing himself, and therefore Judah asked David to become king. Isn't that what happened here? See, so if you just keep that as a key illustration in mind, then you are always very well oriented. Yeah? So if you go through the text and just pick out the main happenings, you will see that it's no more that case of so much of David being hunted by Saul and always fleeing. There it starts with that great incident where David again was cornering Saul in a cave, and he could have killed Saul but didn't do him. But the reason he gave, that is now the new point, you see, the reason he gave that he did not kill him why this is now principle, no more Saul, because we had a similar incident in Saul, that David did not kill Saul when he could have done it. Now he gives the reason for it, namely principle. He says there that the Lord will actually, what was it, redeem righteousness. Huh? Can you hear? The Lord has to do it. Well, we call that principle will have to demonstrate itself. If principle is not going to demonstrate itself, we should not take, so to say, the place of principle and say, then I'm going to do it. We should let principle work out its purpose in principle's own way. Therefore, he had that great courage to stand back and say, no, I'm not going to kill him. But he began to see that principle will do it. Yes? So, it is shown how he returned to principle, you see, that he could put everything back into principle. And at the same time, the Bible shows that Saul returned to spiritualism to save him. He went to that medium, or to that
witch of Endor,
you see, and he went right back to spiritualism, to another principle. So here you have the starting point of principle, letting principle, or first going back to principle, or to the counterfeit of principle, spiritualism. Then the witch said to Saul, said, now you see, now the Lord is thine enemy. No more David is thine enemy. Can you hear that? He could see now, it came to light, that actually Saul was going against principle, not going against David. Yes? See? Always when we come to principle, it is a question, we'll see that next week very definitely in the 10th chapter of the textbook. Always when you come to principle, it's a question of what is the authority behind something? Is principle an authority behind something, or are people, or theories, or dogmas the authority behind it? So that whole period here now is very definitely illustrated by that constant ability to put back everything back to principle or to other authority. So he began to see that he was up against the Lord, not more up against David. And the Lord became his enemy. Because thou hast not obeyed the voice of the Lord. Do you hear principle? Huh? Now it comes out. That it was disobedience to principle that put Saul into such an awkward position. That it wasn't so much his hate and jealousy against David, because he has been able to slay Goliath, and because the people were making a hero out of David and not out of Saul. It wasn't just that little bit of hatred or envy or jealousy. He showed it that he is going against principle. He has not obeyed the principle. And it shows that David, therefore, was grounding himself on the point that whatever happens to his life, that principle would somehow demonstrate itself for him. And so, when he was with the Philistines, the Philistines went up against the Israelites, David and his men should have fought against the Israelites, against his brethren, and that naturally wasn't really in line with David's intention. And then the Philistine, the prince of Philistines, the kings of Philistines said, no, we don't want that David. He's too dangerous for us. Let him stay home. Huh? So he didn't need to go to war against his own. He didn't have to go against his own principle, his own country, against his own ideas. Very, very beautiful illustration that if we stand with principle, somehow a situation would always arrange itself so that we have to never need to be disobedient or unloyal to our principle, that we never have to betray our principle. And then, as that afterwards, you had the battle between Saul and David, where it was first shown that Jonathan was killed, the moral was killed, the moral can't stand principle. See, it can work up to Saul, but the moment it comes to principle, it can't stand it anymore. So Jonathan was killed, and then afterwards Saul killed himself. He was wounded and then killed himself. And David was anointed king of Judah, and his house waxed stronger. You see, can you hear that? You have to read that tone-wise. You see, his house waxed stronger. It gives you, doesn't give you a sense of mind. It doesn't give you a sense of spirit. In spite that the term strong is in it, the strength of spirit. The house waxed stronger. You just see how the whole structure of what he had became more powerful. You get a terrific sense of principle. I guess that's more or less what is in that whole part of principle. Yeah? Okay? Is that more or less clear, the tonality of it? Can you see that one has to be careful not to be sidetracked by one illustration? Sometimes an illustration is very long and doesn't yield actually by itself the meaning until perhaps at the end just comes a sentence or a remark which would give the reason for that illustration, which would just say, well, the Lord will redeem thy righteousness, after a long story or something like that. Just to show, this is a story, now what is the piece of the story, and then perhaps give the idea reigning behind it. It's an art. It's an art to read the Bible. But when one has, you see, if you have within yourself the tonality of the seven, then there is a resounding board within you. When you read the text and the stories, somehow within oneself the chord of a synonym is touched. Is that a good expression, a good illustration? That one of the chord of the harp springs is somehow touched, and every time another one. And according to that, you hear actually then no more the stories, but you hear principle. You hear the righteousness of principle. You hear the structure of principle. You hear the obedience of principle. You hear the self-operative sense of principle. You hear all these things you hear in spite that the terms are not in the book. Yes? This is it, This is it. That's why afterwards, when we then go back to the textbook, and actually I think only when one has a good tonality sense, which has been cultured through the Bible, one can go back to the textbook and begin to read the textbook tone-wise. Because then you read the whole text in a consecutive way, and hear over many, many pages say, mind. And then you hear over many, many pages, that's all has to do with the tone of spirit. no matter what synonymous term appear in the text. That doesn't matter. Just as here it doesn't matter what term appear. It is not a synonymous term, we will see that next week, in the text of the textbook that define the subject. It is the whole text as a symbol for reality that is behind it, that defines the story and the build-up and the layout of the textbook. And here in the Bible we culture ourselves in that beautiful art. Therefore I always feel it is a pity if one only goes so far as to read, say, John Dolly's explanation of the Bible, and says, oh, that's wonderful how he explains this. Yes, I can go along with that. Oh, yes, then you come to another verse, another incident, and how he explains it metaphysically, and say, oh, yes, that's wonderful. I have never thought of that. Isn't that unique? Isn't that quite something? And you go through it, and you have read the book, and then you say, this was really wonderful, and you close it. But that's the end of it. It should be the beginning of it. See? It should be the beginning of it. Because by reading what he says, we don't culture our tonality. We culture it a little bit when we begin to think about it. To close the book and say, now what has that story meant for me? How is it built up? And you begin to ponder it and say, now, what is the main tone, as we did this morning now? What is now the main tone of mind? Can I pinpoint what is the tonality of mind that runs right through those, I don't know how many chapters? What is the main tone that runs through the spirit section, the soul section, the principle section? And begin to ponder that. And then begin to take that into our life. And then suddenly we find ourselves to be that David story. And then we have a lead, so to say, in the David story for our life. And that begins to mature and mature within ourselves, so that actually then we can say, now I have touched the fundamental law of being. And David's story was just one example of that fundamental law. I'm not the David of the year 900 BC or 1000 BC. I'm that law which has been symbolized by David. I'm that law of being today. Then I have made it a scientific law that is eternal. Yes, that was principle. So we come, yes?
You know, there's something which bothered me, and that is the phenomenon of Jonathan, because he actually only did good, and the question is, why was he killed?
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps one could say, from the human point of view, the good, which is the moral, really, if he hadn't been killed, then the spiritual thing has become king. So from the divine point of view, the moral had to go too in order to make room for the spiritual.
Yes. Yeah. We can't go on just with the moral. We'll never make the great. Huh? So actually what it means that the moral must be supplanted by the spiritual. And in the biblical terminology, you call the moral has to go and give place, and then they say it is killed. Huh? They have a very strong language there. Yeah.
I think you can only see that point or understand it if you look at it from the divine point of view. If you look at it from the human point of view, it's not right, you might say, that the good in us has to go too. Why doesn't the good of us, the moral, become king too? Because after all, we can say there was Saul.
I don't think that is meant by that, because I think what they show is that when you have the spiritual, you embrace all the other levels. You express the moral from a spiritual point of view. and you handle the material from a spiritual point of view, make it his servant. You can even make matter a servant. It is not so that when we reach the spiritual, or if we work from the spiritual standpoint, that matter should not be a servant. It can be a servant, it can be a help. But it is dominated by the third degree. Yes? All right, we come to the next period of life. And the whole thing changes. The tonality changes. What is the main tonality in life? Well, we only have one student who knows it. That's always the same one. All right.
Well, true government here is envy.
Yes. That's what Mr. Dolly says. Huh? Yeah. And so you have taken it and have said, Mr. Dolly says so, it must be so. How? Now we always have to ask ourselves, why on earth is he allowed to say so? Huh? How does he arrive at that conclusion? You see, that's another point I have seen as method. I have seen at the time when John Dolly gave those talks, and he brought out those talks after 1 week in print. That was a terrific job. Huh? So he gave the talks, I don't know what, was it on Tuesday or Thursday? It doesn't matter. Say it was on a Thursday, and the next Thursday one could have in print the talk he has given the week before. But he had a whole staff to do that. So at that time, actually, we had a lot to study. If you have to study 32 pages every week and make it your own, it's quite a bit in a spiritual subject. So at that time then, the students were taking those verbatim reports and were swallowing them quickly because the next talk was already on. And so most could not even catch on again because they had the new subject presented orally, and in the pocket they had the preceding one in writing. And so those years, we did... In 2 or 3 years, practically that whole Bible, you see, it's a job. It demanded a lot. And that had, in a way, a great disadvantage. One didn't quite absorb it. The very first point in connection with what we have just been saying was this. Most students just accepted what John Dolly said. They said, oh yes, here in the fifth period it is that the system of government was individualized. And they could see that that has to do with life because the term individualized appeared. But that doesn't do a trick. That doesn't do a trick. What was missing, as far as I could look back at that time, and I had a very good overall view, nobody questioned him. Nobody asked why on earth would he epitomize a whole story like that. It was just accepted. Naturally, when we accept something like that, it is a belief and not an understanding. So it was just exchanging one belief for another belief. It's a hard thing to say, but that's what happened. That's why those Bible books were not really absorbed. Or they would have become our manhood and our whole being, and it would have had a terrific impact on the world. Therefore, what is necessary, you see, is that one takes his findings not in a critical way in order to say I want to disprove him, but in a way that says, I wonder why he has arrived at that conclusion, where we ask ourselves, what are the ideas that I can perceive in these stories that would allow John Dorley to draw this conclusion? And then go further than that and say, how would I today epitomize these stories even clearer or even more precise? That whole trend, that whole activity of being engaged spiritually with the subject is that which gives us the spirit of the letter. And that is necessary. So, if you study John Dorley's work on the Bible, my advice or my hint would be to read them just as you may have done them. Read them and see how it translates biblical symbol in metaphysical symbols. Then ask, why did he put in this metaphysical epitome? Why not in another? Can I see why he did it in this and this? What are the ruling ideas that he must have seen in order to bring forth these epitomes? These are the questions that have to be turned over and turned over in one's mind until one can somehow see the exactness of it, the tonality of it, the meaning of it, and then one begins to make it one's own. Yes, so here we had life, and it was said, it illustrates the government was individualized, and I was asking, how? How can we prove it out of the text? Is that epitome very clear, or could we enlarge it, or talk around it? What happened in that fifth period, you see? What are the ideas that come up again and again and again? This is the question. Huh? Or else we just repeat the statement. Now, what has happened in that period of life here? Yes? Yeah? Well, after a year, I think, study the book, one should be able to say a little bit about it, or... Yeah?
Well, I mean, the way it comes to me is really this idea of that on one hand, the individuality or the fatherhood aspect appears, which impels laying down the full sense of fatherhood or life.
Yes?
More, yeah.
Yes? And with which sense, say, in the biblical stories, could we see how he laid down the false sense of fatherhood or took up the true sense of fatherhood? What sticks out here over and over? That government is individualized, yeah? But that fatherhood sense, how does it show itself? It's a beautiful, beautiful part here. That tone of life here.